I'm Jacob Goldstein. I used to host Planet Money. Now I'm starting a new show. It's called What's Your Problem? Every week on What's Your Problem, entrepreneurs and engineers describe the future they're going to build once they solve a few problems. I'm talking to people trying to figure out how to do things that no one on the planet knows how to do, from creating a drone delivery business to building a car that can truly drive itself. Listen to What's Your Problem on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, a moment that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about how they've navigated exactly these moments. Because as we all know, the only constant is change. So let's make the most of it. Listen to A Slight Change of Plans on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the new Amy and TJ podcast, news anchors Amy Robach and TJ Holmes explore everything from current events to pop culture in a way that's informative, entertaining, and authentically groundbreaking. Join them as they share their voices for the first time since making their own headlines.
This is the first time that we actually get to say what happened and where we are today.
Listen to the Amy and TJ podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In September of 1993, Wilson Rivera and his friend Roger Murphick were lying in wait to rob a pizza delivery driver in South Detroit. They'd been tipped off that the pizza guy was carrying a couple thousand dollars in drug money. But the payoff was less than they expected, only a few hundred dollars. A few nights later, two masked gunmen burst into a nearby house. 20-year-old Doug Williams and his mother, Lavonda, were both shot and killed. The investigators' theory was that Doug had known about the robbery and was killed to keep him from snitching. The police wasted no time in rounding up some local gang members for questioning, including Wilson Rivera.
They arrest me at my house. I'm under the assumption that they're looking for me for the robbery. And so when they take me to homicide, I'm thinking that this is a trick that they're playing on me so that I could go ahead and admit to the robbery.
Wilson had a solid alibi for that night. But one by one, the other suspects were dropped from the investigation. By the time Wilson went to trial, he was the only one left.
My name is Wilson Rivera, and for the last 30 years, I've been serving time for a crime I did not commit.
From Lava for Good, this is Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Today, Wilson Rivera. Wilson Rivera was born in 1974 in Southwest Detroit.
My whole family is Puerto Rican. My mother was born in Chicago, but my father was born in Puerto Rico. So we have family on both sides of the ocean, if you will. I spent most of my time as a teenager in Detroit, but I was raised in Puerto Rico. My mother tells me that as a child, she said I was a pretty lively individual as a child. I'm animated, hyper to a degree. But always, she said, I always smiled.
But the family had its troubles. Both of Wilson's parents struggled with substance abuse.
My father was an alcoholic. He was, as far as I could remember, images. I could see my father being an abuser, getting in domestic abuse. My mother ended up engaging in drugs, drinking. And so her life at that time, my mother had a lot of personal issues and personal demons that she was struggling against, that she never could deal with at the time. So her life was spiraling out of control.
Wilson's parents separated, and his father ended up moving back to Puerto Rico. His mother did her best to care for Wilson and his brother, Antonio.
My mother did struggle at the time, but she made do with what we had. I don't remember going hungry, and we always had something to eat, whether it was from WIC or food stamps or Focus Hope. I can honestly say that we became somewhat of introverts. Me and my brother, we could depend on each other, but that was about it, only because throughout our childhood, it was always me and him that were together, me and my older brother. He's older by 1 year, Antonio.
For most of his childhood, Wilson went back and forth between their mother in Detroit and their father in Puerto Rico. In 1984, when he was 10, they moved back to Detroit. But he struggled in school.
I had the language barrier. We didn't really speak English. They placed us in bilingual classes where basically we were just put in a classroom and, as far as I can remember, just left there. So you become kind of like ostracized. And I began to resent school. I was constantly getting into fights in school and getting in trouble.
The trouble continued through his teens.
I used to be a member. We were through a local street gang, Camel Boys Incorporated, CBI. And consequently, we was involved in a lot of mischievous behavior acts in the neighborhood. And I started getting in trouble, shoplifting and things of that nature at that time, and skipping out of school.
But soon, the neighborhood mischief was escalating into something else.
By about 1987, Southwest Detroit began to receive an influx of national gangs. There were two or three primary gangs from Chicago who ended up coming to Southwest Detroit, and they began to recruit individuals. And what ends up happening, local street gangs in the neighborhood, we all banded as one together, and we were constantly fighting with these other gangs.
In 1990, when Wilson was 16, one of his friends was shot in the face by a member of a rival gang. This led to an incident that would end up having deep repercussions for Wilson.
Basically, one of my other friends went and got a weapon, a shotgun, and brought me the shotgun, and I opened fire at the rival gang. And as I fled the scene, I came face to face with a member of the Detroit police. I pulled the weapon out, and as I pulled the weapon out, I discharged it, and it didn't hit him. Later on the following day, I was arrested, and eventually I pled guilty to the offense.
He was charged with attempt to commit bodily harm on a police officer.
That's what I went to juvenile for.
Wilson spent over 2 years at the Maxey Boys Training School, a juvenile correction facility, about an hour outside of Detroit. And when he was released in 1993, he still hadn't graduated high school, but he did manage to find a job in a factory.
At the time I was working, but then I had suffered a hand injury, a gunshot wound, where I couldn't really use my hand and keep up with the production. So instead of being fired, I quit the job. And the way that I would survive, it would be either petty hustle or I would engage in small, and I'm not minimizing it, but it was what we would consider small robberies in the neighborhood. And it would be dope dealers or things of the sort.
Wilson got by on the petty crimes and was still running with the Camel Boys. But when he was around 19, his girlfriend told him some news that made him want to change his lifestyle.
I was excited when I found out that she was pregnant. I wouldn't say I was scared, but I knew that I wanted to make like a shift in my life. I wanted to be present for my daughters.
And to Wilson, that meant leaving gang life behind. But he found that was easier said than done.
I had started applying for jobs. I wanted to try to see if I could get back in the old factory where I was working at, but maybe in a different position where it didn't require for me to work in the machines that I had to be working on before. Unfortunately, though, I still live in the same environment, though. The neighborhood where I lived at, like, my house was smack dead in the middle of basically all the rival gangs that I was in fights with. So there was one of them things where it was kind of constantly going back and forth.
Wilson was living in the neighborhood, spending his nights at his girlfriend's house and leaving early in the morning to try and avoid the other gangs.
I figured that me going home in the mornings would be a lot safer as opposed to, you know, coming home at midnight or late at nighttime, because that by that time, the rival gangs could see that you're home.
Wilson had decided to give up the petty crime and gang life, but he hadn't found a job yet, and he was still involved with the same crowd. One of his friends, Cal Mata, was in a gang called the Cashflow Posse, a gang that the Camel Boys had an alliance with. Cal also worked at a local pizza shop, and one day, Cal approached Wilson and his friend, Roger Murphick, with a scheme to make some easy money.
What he had informed us was that there was a guy that was delivering pizzas, but he was doing so while at the same time selling drugs. We were led to believe that this person had at least $2,000 from drug proceeds on himself.
On September 12th, 1993, Wilson and Roger were armed and waiting to rob the pizza guy along his route. But he was taking longer than they expected, so they thought they might have missed him. Roger knew a guy named Douglas Williams who lived across the street, and he went over to Doug's house to ask if he could use the phone.
Eventually, the pizza delivery guy comes and we robbed the guy, and he didn't have no $2,000. He didn't have $800. The individual actually only had $400. So when Cal comes to the apartment after he gets out of work at 10 o'clock, then he asked for his portion of the money. I told him he wasn't going to get the money because he lied about what the guy had. And so we fell out over that.
And that should have been that. A robbery and a small argument over a few $100s. But it wasn't. 20-year-old Douglas Williams lived with his parents, LaVonda and Daniel Brown. And 3 days after the pizza man was robbed, two men burst into their house wearing ski masks. One of the intruders shot and killed both Doug and LaVonda. But Daniel, Doug's father, survived. When he talked with police shortly afterwards, Daniel told them that Doug had known about the armed robbery from a few days before.
Daniel Brown said that his son, Doug, had told him that Wilson Rivera and Roger Murphick were the two individuals involved in that armed robbery.
This is Wilson's post-conviction attorney, Rachel Wolf.
There was plenty there for the prosecution to latch onto and for the police to investigate because they knew exactly who Roger Murphick and Wilson Rivera were at the time.
And one member of the Detroit Police Department, Officer Gerald Packard, had his own reasons for focusing on Wilson. The officer that Wilson had shot at back when he was 16, Officer Ayala, was Packard's partner.
So Officer Packard knew Wilson. He knew that he had gotten what I imagine Packard would assume is a short sentence for something like that. He was not on the homicide team. He was not part of the homicide investigation, but he was the one when he heard that Roger and Wilson were potentially suspects. He was the one that went to Wilson's apartment, knocking on the door, and then ultimately, once the warrant was obtained, just busted right in to the apartment.
And when they arrest me at my house, I'm under the assumption that they're looking for me for the robbery. And so when they take me to homicide, Sergeant Morrell tells me that he's arrested me for murder. I'm thinking that this is a trick that they're playing on me so that I could go ahead and admit to the robbery.
But Wilson knew nothing about the homicide. The night of the shooting, he had been with his girlfriend and her mother at their house. He didn't learn about the shooting until the next day when he found out that Roger had also been arrested.
I seen Roger at homicide, and then when they put us in a bullpen, and that's when I asked Roger, like, what's going on? And he explained to me what had actually taken place with the murder, with the homicides. Now, again, I'm operating under this concept of loyalty that we have within the gang, right? So I'm not going to say nothing. They're not going to say nothing, you know, and we just take it out and see what happens. In my mind, I'm assuming that eventually the facts are going to bear me out. Since I don't have nothing to do with it, it's just a matter of time before I'm cleared. Unfortunately, as we can see, that's not what ended up taking place.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
In the new Amy and TJ podcast, Amy Robach and TJ Holmes, a renowned broadcasting team with decades of experience delivering headline news and captivating viewers nationwide, are sharing their voices and perspectives in a way you've never heard before. They explore meaningful conversations about current events, pop culture, and everything in between. Nothing is off limits.
This was a scandal that wasn't.
Yeah.
And this was not what you've been sold.
The Amy and TJ podcast is guaranteed to be informative, entertaining, and above all, authentic. It marks the first time Robach and Holmes speak publicly since their own names became a part of the headlines.
This is the first time that we actually get to say what happened and where we are today.
Listen to the Amy and TJ podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Kate
and Oliver
Hudson,
host of the new podcast.
Well, it's not new, but we are at iHeartRadio.
But it's called Sibling Revelry. That's right.
We started this show because we just wanted to hang out together. We decided a couple of years back, you know what? No one talks about siblings and that dynamic.
The siblings, they know each other better than anybody.
Yes.
You know, a lot of the time.
And we get inspired by other siblings. I think other siblings make us want to be better siblings.
100%. You know how many times shows that we have done?
I wish we were like that. I'm like not a great sister.
I know. I'm like, I'm terrible.
Anyway, I hope you love our show. We love doing it. Listen to Sibling Revelry on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
You take my breath away.
I spent the last 15 years of my life fighting like hell to make sure that I never ended up here. But then I met her.
The name's Anna.
Hey, Anna. I'm Nico. Didn't realize you were a professional musician.
From Interval Presents, a new romantic thriller podcast starring Jason Derulo and Alexandra Shipp.
There's something about you that I haven't been able to look away from.
Nico, we don't even know each other.
There's no turning back if we do this.
I've already made my decision.
This is what happens when you don't follow orders, Nicholas.
No!
Listen to Underwater on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the aftermath of the shooting, the Detroit Homicide Squad, headed up by Officer Kerry Russell, rounded up a number of local gang members and charged them with the murders. One of the first to be arrested was Cal Mata.
They knew they were looking for Wilson and Roger. They went to this house that was a known location for both the Cash Flow Posse gang and the Camel Boys gang. So they came in, they arrested Cal. At that time, he was the only person in that apartment with a number of firearms. They also found a ski mask and a jacket inside of that apartment that they ultimately seized and ended up admitting at trial as well.
While in custody, Cal told Officer Packard that he had heard Wilson and Roger talking about Doug Williams, calling him a snitch. Cal took that to mean they were going to take steps to make sure Doug couldn't report them for the robbery. The police also brought in a couple of other gang members for questioning, Armando Campos and Ephraim Garcia. Both of them were in the Cash Flow Posse, and according to Wilson, Ephraim was trying to climb the ranks in the gang.
The way that the gang was operating was that in order for an individual to move up in the ranks, right, to either become an enforcer or treasurer or whatever the other upper echelon in the gang, what they would have to do is they would have to, what we call back then, put in work. You know, whether it be if you rob somebody, if you shot somebody, if you jump somebody in the schools and all that, the reputation of that, whatever you do, goes to the gang. So in order for Ephraim to move up in the ranks in his gang, he wanted to put in the work.
And in this case, the work was to keep Doug Williams from snitching about the pizza robbery. Wilson says that day at the jail, Roger told him exactly how it had gone down.
And so Roger and Ephraim go to the house where the witness of the robbery was. And Ephraim kicks down the door and opens fire and hits Doug. And then Roger comes from the other side and hits Doug. And then as Doug's mother attempts to flee the residence, Roger opens fire on him, and he hits her as well.
After what Roger told him, Wilson was confident that the truth would come out and he'd be released. But Roger never confessed to anyone else, and the homicide team continued to question Wilson.
And I told him exactly where I was at. I told him I was spending the night with my daughter's mother. She was at the time about 2.5 months pregnant. Like, in my mind, I know where I was at. So I gave him the alibi, gave him everything where I was at and everything. And my expectation was that they would go talk to my daughter's mother, but that never took place.
When Armando Campos was questioned, he told police that the day after the homicide, Roger had turned up at his house, desperate for money.
Roger said, "I just smoked someone. I need as much money as possible. I got to get out of town." And then when questioned a little further, Armando also said, yeah, he mentioned Wilson too. He mentioned Wilson was there too.
Wilson and Roger were now the primary suspects, and both were charged with the murders. In September of 1993, a joint preliminary hearing was held at which Cal and Armando testified. Both repeated what they had told police. But when Roger Murphick went to trial in April of 1994, Armando changed his story.
Armando recanted everything he had said at the preliminary examination. He said, "No, I never made those statements. The only reason that I made those statements is because I was arrested. You know, I was charged. I was threatened by the police. I said exactly what they wanted me to say." Roger, of course, was acquitted of all of the charges.
But Wilson remained in jail. He went to trial a few months later on September 6th, 1994. The judge was Helen Brown and the prosecutor was Lisa Lindsay. As far as physical evidence, there wasn't much for the state to present.
We don't have fingerprints. They didn't fingerprint the shell casings or anything in the house at the time. Obviously, there's no DNA or anything like that. It was a really quick homicide.
Officer Packard and the homicide squad had searched Wilson's home the day they arrested him.
And they find two firearms and two ski masks, one of which was black or dark blue in color. The other one was a multicolored. Those guns were tested against some of the shell casings that were recovered in the house. And there was a bullet, I believe, recovered from Doug's body during the autopsy. And there wasn't a match. So conclusively, neither of the weapons found in Wilson's home were involved in the homicide. They were allowed, however, to admit them at trial, along with a bunch of ammunition that they found in Wilson's home, none of which was the right caliber to be involved in the homicide either.
But they presented it as if it could be.
They sure did. Yeah, they presented all of that to the jury.
The state relied heavily on police and witness testimony to make their case. But there wasn't much of that either.
Daniel Brown testified to the armed robbery and named these two co-defendants as perpetrators of that armed robbery. And then they also had testimony from one other witness, Cal Mata.
Cal repeated the statement he had given the police, that he had heard Wilson and Roger talking about getting rid of Doug Williams. And that was about it for the prosecution's case.
The officer in charge of the case, you know, who was basically the one that was responsible for taking all the testimony from all these witnesses and all that, she failed to show up for my trial, even though she knew my trial was set for that date. And so all of these things that was taking place, I'm looking at what was going on. I was like, yeah, in my mind, I was hoping that the judge was going to say, you know, I'm going to interfere in this thing here and I'm going to dismiss it for the lack of evidence and because of what was going on with the prosecutors failing to produce their witnesses.
And not only that, Wilson had an alibi. Remember, on the night of the murders, he'd been with his girlfriend, but she never testified at trial. And surprisingly, Armando Campos did not appear either.
So when my attorney at the time, Mr. Cripps, asked to have a due diligence hearing as to why Armando is not showing up to testify, we find out that the prosecutor at the time had failed to subpoena Armando. And so he never showed up to testify because he never knew.
I think ultimately it's entirely possible that Roger was acquitted and Wilson was convicted because of the absence of Armando Campos's testimony.
On September 9th of 1994, the jury found Wilson Rivera guilty of the premeditated murders of Donald Williams and LaVonda Brown. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
After I came to prison, I think within the first year, I witnessed an inmate get into a fight and he got stabbed. Eventually, he died from the stab wound and he basically bled out. And so they locked us down and I told myself, yeah, that's not going to happen to me. You know, so I went into whole defensive posturing and any issue that I had, I either was going to get into a fight, I wasn't going to wait for anybody to stab me or try to kill me in prison. And so what I ended up doing, I started acting out first. So if I felt that we had an issue, I would act first. And I actually caught a couple of assault tickets in prison. I spent several years in maximum security, several years in the hole. You know, I didn't care much about where I was at in prison at that time, you know, and had just turned 20 and being sentenced to life without parole. And the only thing that kind of kept me to a degree balanced out was that I wanted to see my daughter.
While Wilson was in jail awaiting trial, his daughter, Sierra, was born.
The first time that I got a chance to see her was actually during my sentencing. So the time that I'm being sentenced to life without parole, I'm actually paying more so attention to my daughter, who basically was just a few months old at the time, you know.
He's been in prison my whole life. So what I do know is from the relationship we formed with him being in prison.
This is Wilson's daughter, Sierra Ramirez.
He's funny. He's intelligent. Him and I are a lot alike, very talkative. He's an encourager. You know, it's only 15-minute phone calls at a time, but I feel pretty open when I talk with him.
What was that like growing up, only knowing your father from prison, from visiting rooms?
I guess for me, it was a norm. I didn't see it as anything weird because it was all I knew, basically. You know, when I started getting older and going to my friend's house, and I'm like, oh, okay, this is a little bit different. You know, there's a different dynamic that comes from having your dad in your life. And I had him to an extent, but not fully. And now as an adult, when I look back, I see how that impacted me just as a woman, as a girl growing up, you know, as a wife, how it impacted me.
Did you ever feel angry or resentful towards your dad?
I did feel some anger with him when I was younger. I felt very abandoned, and I did tell him I was angry at him and felt like he made the choice to leave me knowing I was coming. He was very receptive, you know. He apologized, and he's definitely done what he can as a father to his best of his ability, you know. Whether when I was young, he would send me, you know, we're Hispanic. He would send me tapes to learn Spanish, and he would send me these books and make me bracelets and stuff like that. He's always called. I've always seen him. He's always sent cards. He's definitely done what he can. I give that to him for sure.
In the new Amy and TJ podcast, Amy Robach and TJ Holmes, a renowned broadcasting team with decades of experience delivering headline news and captivating viewers nationwide, are sharing their voices and perspectives in a way you've never heard before. They explore meaningful conversations about current events, pop culture, and everything in between. Nothing is off limits.
This was a scandal that wasn't.
Yeah.
And this was not what you've been sold.
The Amy and TJ podcast is guaranteed to be informative, entertaining, and above all, authentic. It marks the first time Robach and Holmes speak publicly since their own names became a part of the headlines.
This is the first time that we actually get to say what happened and where we are today.
Listen to the Amy and TJ podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Kate.
And Oliver.
Hudson!
Host of the new podcast,
Well, it's not new, but we are at
iHeartRadio. But it's called Sibling Revelry. That's right.
We started this show because we just wanted to hang out together. We decided a couple years back, you know what? No one talks about siblings in that dynamic.
The siblings, they know each other better than anybody.
Yes.
You know, a lot of the time.
And we get inspired by other siblings. I think other siblings make us want to be better siblings.
100%. You know how many times shows that we have done?
And I wish we were like that. I'm like not a great
sister. I know. I'm like, I'm terrible.
Anyway, I hope you love our show. We love doing it. Listen to Sibling Revelry on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
You take my breath away.
I spent the last 15 years of my life fighting like hell to make sure that I never ended up here. But then, I met her.
The name's Anna.
Hey, Anna. I'm Nico. Didn't realize you were a professional musician.
From Interval Presents, a new romantic thriller podcast starring Jason Derulo and Alexandra Shipp.
There's something about you that I haven't been able to look away from.
Nico, we don't even know each other.
There's no turning back if we do this.
I've already made my decision.
This is what happens when you don't follow orders. Nicholas.
No!
Listen to Underwater on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Soon after his conviction, Wilson's attorney filed a direct appeal based on prosecutorial misconduct and the improper admission of the firearms found at his house, which had been found to be not connected to the murders. The courts denied the appeal, and Wilson knew that if he wanted to get out of prison, he would have to dedicate all of his time and resources to proving his innocence.
After about 17 years in prison, of going through all these ups and downs and the disappointment with the case, I started investing more time in the case, and I started working, saving my money that I earned from my prison detail, and basically I would try to hire my private investigators to try to find the information that I needed to prove my innocence. I decided to start studying the law myself, and eventually I got trained as a legal writer or a prison paralegal, and I did that shift in 2010.
Then in 2018, Rachel Wolf began working on Wilson's case.
It was funny. When Wilson and I first met, he was worried about me because I was young and because and he said, this is a quote, sound like a Republican. So I had to assure him that that wasn't going to be an issue. So when I first went to meet him, I didn't know what to expect, but we clicked right away.
Initially, Rachel was skeptical about the strength of Wilson's argument.
You know, how are we going to prove this case? There is a motive, and people find that very, very convincing. So regardless of the strength of the evidence as it exists or the existence of other possible suspects, which there are, it's easy for people to latch onto and easy for them to say, well, look, of course he did it. He had a reason to do it, you know, without looking any closer at the case.
So what convinced you of his innocence, or what made you want to keep digging?
When I started talking to people, and especially, you know, like the leaders of the Cash Flow Posse and some other members of, you know, some other people who were involved in the gang activity at that time, I started just getting some information that did not jive with the prosecutor's theory.
For one thing, remember Ephraim Garcia? He was arrested in the DPD roundup along with Roger Murphick, and Roger had told Wilson straight out that he and Ephraim had done the killings. But somehow, Ephraim was dropped from the case early on.
We didn't know at the time. They subjected Ephraim Garcia to a polygraph, and he failed it. But they didn't disclose it to Wilson's defense counsel. He didn't know about it at the time of trial. We discovered that much later on, and that's you know, part of the basis for my legal challenge to his case is that he should have had this evidence there was this suspect, but we know that Ephraim Garcia was released after that. He wasn't investigated for involvement in this homicide any further by the Detroit Police Department. They started looking for Roger and Wilson, and I don't think they were going to change their minds at any point. Yeah, Ephraim fit the description. He was there. He failed his poly, but they did. They wanted Roger and they wanted Wilson.
Officer Packard especially wanted Wilson. He hadn't forgotten it was Wilson who had shot at his partner, Officer Ayala.
He was, I think, central to this case and maybe, you know, part of the reason they didn't investigate Ephraim any further or any other possible suspects. Ephraim Garcia was indicted for the exact same homicide 5 years later. He never actually ended up with that homicide conviction. He's incarcerated now for several additional homicides.
They've also uncovered previously undisclosed information about Cal's testimony.
Cal was on probation, and he also was found and arrested with guns and drugs in a known gang location. His probation was dismissed very shortly after Wilson's trial and sentencing, and he was never charged. He was initially actually charged with the homicide, and then ultimately they dismissed that, and then they never even charged him with any of the other offenses.
Then there's the matter of proving Wilson's alibi.
So he had his girlfriend at the time. He was with her at her mother's house. He stayed the night there, I think, until early morning hours. We're talking like 2 a.m., 3 a.m.
Wilson's girlfriend never testified to this at trial. When Rachel interviewed her, she found out why.
Because she was scared. She says an individual in a suit approached her in the hallway outside of the courtroom and said, "Look, we're holding your brother. He's currently facing these additional charges. If you go in there and testify, you know, we're going to reconsider the severity of the charges and the possible sentence against your brother." And so she was too afraid to testify. And I think her testimony probably would have made a difference.
Rachel says she's spoken with other potential witnesses from the neighborhood, people who have knowledge of what actually happened. But they have similar reasons for not coming forward.
They're all afraid of the police. They're all afraid of the prosecutor and of coming into court, just because I think that's what their lived experience has taught them to fear. They are hesitant to come into court. And that's made the investigation of this case a little more difficult as well, is that I have witnesses who were willing to provide me with information that are not willing to come in and testify in court. They're not willing to talk to, you know, the prosecutor's conviction integrity unit. They're just not going to do that.
That's so interesting. They're more scared of the law enforcement than they are of snitching and being a snitch on the street.
Yeah, at least that's what they're telling me.
According to Rachel, all of this is tied in with the culture in the Detroit Police Department at the time. People in the community had little reason to trust the cops and plenty of reason to fear them.
They had this practice, they called it witness roundups. You're not supposed to arrest somebody without probable cause. But what they would do, and they did it in Wilson's case, they would go and everybody who they thought was a possible witness, they would charge them with the underlying offense. So in a homicide investigation, you're all charged with homicide. And then they would bring them in, hold them, interview them.
The place was Detroit Police Headquarters at 1300 Bobien, and it was notorious for being the seat of police corruption.
All the witnesses, all the clients that I have, you say 1300 Bobien, everybody knows exactly what you're talking about. That interview room that they used to take people is awful. Like, cockroaches are in there. They don't give you food. You know, you can't see out. So you'll see through the 1990s, these witnesses all testifying, like, I was held for like 3 days. I was charged with a homicide. And of course they weren't involved. You know they weren't. But that's what DPD was doing. So in the late 1980s and all throughout the 90s, there was significant corruption within the Detroit Police Department.
In the year 2000, 7 years after Wilson's conviction, the Department of Justice ran an investigation of the DPD that turned up a number of significant violations.
In 1995, Carlos Rodriguez, who was one of the investigators on Wilson's homicide team, was indicted along with four other officers for operating a narcotics ring through the 4th Precinct in the city of Detroit. The entire DPD forensics lab was shut down in 2008 because the investigators had found widespread errors in their analysis. And then a few years later, David Pouch, the firearms examiner in Wilson's case, was found to have intentionally fabricated ballistics evidence to obtain a conviction in a 1992 case. So a year before he testified at Wilson's trial, he had intentionally fabricated ballistics evidence. That individual, to his case, his name is Desmond Ricks. He was also exonerated on that basis.
With all of this new information to present, Rachel is hopeful that Wilson will be granted a new trial.
Short of a commutation or pardon from the governor, there's one other way you can get out of prison when you have a life without parole sentence, and that is through a motion for relief from judgment. So basically what you do is you go back to the state court, back to the same court that convicted you in the first place, and you say, I'm entitled to a new trial for this reason, this reason, and this reason. So you investigate the hell out of everything because you only get one chance. So now that we have all of that evidence collected, there are some significant legal challenges that we can raise. One of them, of course, is the Brady violation. Wilson should have had information that Ephraim Garcia was given a polygraph examination and failed it so that he would be able to properly investigate that avenue of defense. And he wasn't. So that's certainly one of our claims. I think we were prepared to go to court probably about 2 years ago. And so we'll be moving forward very quickly now.
And in the meantime, in addition to becoming a prison paralegal, Wilson has accomplished another important goal. In May of 2023, he graduated magna cum laude from Calvin University.
I was going for a bachelor's degree in faith and community leadership with a minor in social work. The highest grade I ever completed was the 7th grade. I never went to high school. And so being able to kind of like accomplish not just attaining a college degree, but with a high GPA, 3.93, it was personally a huge accomplishment, and it just gave me a huge sense of self-worth as well.
So your daughter, Sierra, was telling me that she was able to go to your graduation.
That to me right there, it's invaluable. I mean, it's a moment that I look at the picture, and I'm filled with such a, man, I'm extremely proud of my daughter. Like I said, she's my heart.
It was nice, you know, to be able to be there and watch him do like kind of like this normal thing. It was awesome to see. It made me feel proud of him. You know, I feel like it was a great example of how even given his circumstances, he was able to accomplish something so great. It was very inspiring.
And Sierra credits her father with inspiring her in other ways.
I've seen what a wonderful person he is and how someone, like I said, can make bad choices at one point in their life, but then, you know, they can turn that around and not let that define them and contain them no matter where they're at being in prison. I think it's important to know your own worth and not see other people's decisions as how worthy you are, I guess, because that's how I felt. I felt like I was unworthy of love and I was someone who just had this abandonment, and, you know, I guess it would be that doesn't define who you are as a person. I guess for me, it was just, you know, learning my identity and who I am aside from that, you know.
So do you and your dad ever talk about maybe the future, anything like that?
He talks about, like, when, you know, if he gets out, he would love to move here. Yeah, he would love to move here and, you know, spend time with me and my daughter. And, you know, I may not have been able to have a childhood with him, but my children being able to have him around and, you know, see that side of him that I never got to see, that I will grow to see. Yeah, I think that would be pretty awesome.
Wilson believes that his experience gave him a perspective that can make a difference to others, even while he remains behind bars.
I've seen people depressed. I've seen people commit suicide. I've seen people attempt suicide, you know? And so this is the environment. And I told myself, well, because I have this education, while I'm still fighting to prove my innocence, I could be of assistance to these individuals around me as well.
So when you get out, what do you want to do?
I would love to be able to work with youth and gangs. I would love to be able to step out of prison and start programs, mentoring programs, tutoring programs, because I know the value of that. Programs that help interpret, you know, because I know how that feels not to be able to express your feelings because you don't have the proper words in English to do so. So these are kind of things that I would love to be effective in our community as well. I no longer kind of view myself as this individual who's just in prison and poor me, you know. When I figured out that even though I'm still fighting for my freedom to prove my innocence, I could still be effective in helping other individuals.
If you'd like to help support Wilson in his fight to prove his innocence, go to freewilsonrivera.com. We'll post that link in the episode description. Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Please support your local innocence organizations and go to the links in the episode description to see how you can help. I'd like to thank our executive producers, Jason Flom, Jeff Kempler, and Kevin Wirtis, as well as senior producer Annie Chelsea, producer Kathleen Fink, story editor Hannah Beal, and researcher Shelby Sorrells. Mixing and sound design are by Jackie Pauly, with additional production by Jeff Clyburn and Connor Hall. The music in this production is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on all platforms at Maggie Freeling. Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling is a production of Lava for Good podcasts in association with Signal Company Number One.
I'm Jacob Goldstein. I used to host Planet Money. Now I'm starting a new show. It's called What's Your Problem? Every week on What's Your Problem, entrepreneurs and engineers describe the future they're going to build once they solve a few problems. I'm talking to people trying to figure out how to do things that no one on the planet knows how to do, from creating a drone delivery business to building a car that can truly drive itself. Listen to What's Your Problem on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Kate
and Oliver
Hudson,
host of the new podcast, Sibling Revelry. That's right.
We started this show because, you know what? No one talks about siblings and that dynamic.
The siblings, they know each other better than anybody.
Yes.
You know.
Listen to Sibling Revelry on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
In the new Amy and TJ podcast, news anchors Amy Robach and TJ Holmes explore everything from current events to pop culture in a way that's informative, entertaining, and authentically groundbreaking. Join them as they share their voices for the first time since making their own headlines.
This is the first time that we actually get to say what happened and where we are today.
Listen to the Amy and TJ podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.